Benedict Arnold. Likely you're familiar with that name. He was a man born in Connecticut back in 1741. And after he apprenticed during his younger life, he got involved with the militia during the French and Indian War, which began in 1754. He later became a successful leader and joined the Continental Army when the Revolutionary War began between Great Britain and the 13 American colonies in 1775. During the war, Arnold was a man who proved himself brave and skillful in his leading. He helped Ethan Allen's troops, maybe you're familiar with that name as well, in capturing Fort Ticonderoga, and then he participated in the attack on British Quebec later that year. He was promoted because of his military accomplishments to Brigadier General in the young, not as yet named American, but American Army. Arnold distinguished himself in campaigns at Lake Champlain and Saratoga, and he gained support of one George Washington. So his military career was going along well. However, he began to incur great debt after marriage to a gal, and over the next several years, as his debt increased, he also was overlooked time and time again for promotion in the army. So the debt, as it piled up, and the resentment that built up in his heart caused Arnold to leave the American army and move over toward the British. In 1780, he was given charge of West Point, the place that would later become the home of the U.S. Military Academy. And when he was at West Point, he contacted some of the British forces and agreed with a pact to hand over West Point to the British. Well, the conspiracy was uncovered, and that never came to fruition, but Arnold indeed went from American patriot to a traitor and serving in the British Army. He conducted military campaigns for the British in Virginia and also Connecticut, and later he moved to England, and though he never received everything that the British had promised him, he died there in London in 1801. Well, Benedict Arnold, the name is synonymous with traitor. The name is synonymous with somebody who's guilty of treason. And you can imagine the devastation caused by a traitor, an enemy who's actually within the camp. Well, the same thing is true in our own lives. There's an enemy within our own hearts, an enemy within our own ranks, and that enemy is sin. The aliveness of sin in all of our lives as we follow Christ. So with that in mind, let's look at James chapter 1, verses 13 through 16. James writes, "Let no one say when he is tempted, 'I am being tempted by God.' For God cannot be tempted by evil, and he himself does not tempt anyone. But each one is tempted when he is carried away and enticed by his own lust. Then when lust has conceived, it gives birth to sin, and when sin is accomplished, it brings forth death. Do not be deceived, my beloved brethren." As we look at this short passage, we're going to see first the lineage of sin, there in verses 13 and 14. Then we're going to see the life cycle of sin and how it functions within our own souls. And finally, the lie of sin, there in verse 16. So let's look at the lineage first of all, and you see first that there's temptation that's described there. James begins and says, "Let no one say when he is tempted." He's going to communicate to us where temptation does not originate first before he gets to the details. So when he says, "Let no one say this," he is prohibiting a habit, something that is normal, that is common among followers of God, that they would say something regarding temptation and God that's not true. And so James wants to stop that in its tracks and cause people not to ever go down that road again, as tempting as it might be in the midst of temptation, to say these things. Let no one say, verse 13, when he is tempted, "I am being tempted by God." This person is in the midst of a trial.
He is in the midst of a straining of his faith. And when we're in the midst of difficulty, this is when our true theology comes out. When we're sitting comfortably, peacefully, nothing difficult inside or outside, we say all sorts of things about God and about our commitment to Him. I would die for God. God is the greatest. He is totally good. He's totally holy. He's completely benefited my life in so many ways. I would never turn my back on Him or say anything against Him. And we can confidently say that. And we really do believe that when we're sitting comfortably. But when the pressure is turned up, when the screws start to turn, that's when the truth comes out, what we really think. Because we're not at that time so quick to say great things about God because our life is difficult. We know He's powerful enough to take all these difficulties away, but He's allowing them to come in. And so it changes our thinking, and the pressure reveals what's really going on inside. That should highlight in our minds one of the reasons God does allow difficulty to come in, because He wants us to see what we really believe, who we really trust, where our heart really is focused. And so He allows these things to happen. Let no one say when he is being tempted, I am being tempted by God. Why would somebody say this? Why would they put the blame on God, as it were, when they're being tempted? Well, shifting the blame from difficulty in your own life to somebody else is as common and as old as men are on the earth and as long as man has ever existed. Since the fall, man has blamed God for his difficulty. You remember there in the garden, after Adam and Eve ate from the tree that they weren't supposed to eat from, God came to them, confronted them. Adam says what? The woman, there's the first blame, whom you gave to me, there's the second. She's the one who caused this. Actually, God, you're the one who caused this because I didn't ask for this woman. You just brought her to me, and see what she made me do? Ultimately, it's your fault. And so this pattern that began with Adam and Eve has continued down through history for those who even have a thinking of God in their own minds. When temptation comes, when difficulty comes, let's go ahead and include God in the blame. Now, interesting, look here at the word tempted in verse 13, and then look up at the word trials in verse 2. These are the same word, the same form of the word, perosmos, in the Greek. And you can understand the connection between trials and temptations. The temptation, in and of itself, is a trial. A trial is anything that's difficult. The temptation, when you're wrestling with, should I follow this temptation or fight against it, that's a trial. A trial is the testing of your faith, and the temptation is the pathway that you would take to fail that test, to go away from God and His ways. And so the thought process in bringing God into this is that, well, God is sovereign, He's all-powerful, He's given me faith, He must be tempting me right here in this difficulty. He must be the one who is the author of this test. While God allows testing, it is clear from looking just at this one verse that God is not the one who tempts. He's not the one who leads us to fall away from Him. Think of what it says over in 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 13, a verse you should have memorized. God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able, but with the temptation will provide the way of escape also, that you may be able to endure it. So the way He's involved is in that word allow. He allows it to happen. We see that in the story of Job. We see Satan accuse him, and God say, okay, you can go and bring about difficulty, tragedy in his life. God allows that for His own purposes. But He's not the one who tempts. He's not the one who's involved in leading us into sin. So there's a connection. Well, what's wrong with saying this about God? Besides it being untrue, and you'd be disobeying what it says right here in James 1:13, how might a person be led astray if he or she believes this, if he or she believes that God's the one who's tempting me? Well, the thought process might go something like this. God is tempting me or testing me. So if I fall, the blame can be at least partly put on him. Therefore, if I fall, it won't be as serious as if it were all my fault, because I can spread the blame around. And I don't have to work so hard to fight against this temptation, because if I move into it and sin, then it will be okay, it will be understood by God, it's not that big of a deal. This type of thinking is more dangerous than trying to blame Satan. You know, the devil made me do it. If God is to blame for my failure, then he would have to understand it and accept it and overlook it, because he's the one who initiated it. You can see how wrong doctrine would lead you to wrong living. And so the focus that James puts our minds on right here at the beginning of this passage is, think correctly about God. And that will help you in your fight against temptation. Now, look at the reason it is false. The rest of verse 13. Therefore, God cannot be tempted by evil, and he himself does not tempt anybody. God cannot be tempted by evil. He cannot be tempted of evil things. We know God is all-knowing. He is omniscient. But experientially, we understand that he is unversed in evil. He has no experience with what it is like to do something wrong, to do something sinful, to do something unrighteous. He's entirely free from it. He's not affected by evil. He is not somebody as a being who is willing to allow evil to go coexist with him. He is separate from it. The Bible uses the words holy, meaning altogether apart or distinct from sin or evil. God cannot be induced to act according with evil. He's immovable in this. He's completely holy, completely self-sufficient, needing nothing. So when it says God cannot be tempted by evil, there's nothing that evil could offer him that he could say, oh, that looks good, or oh, that's interesting, or oh, maybe I should go this way and off the righteous path to do this action or think that thought. God's not going to be tempted by that, because he in and of himself is completely self-sufficient, completely holy. He's going to think completely rightly about that temptation and know it's evil and wrong, and it's not going to affect him. We're thankful for that. We're thankful that our God's immovable, because what it says in Scripture has been true of him from eternity past, and it will remain true forever. I mean, what if God could be moved? What if your salvation was not secure, and he said, well, I tried to work it out, but I went astray, and I decided this was the end of eternity with heaven and hell and all these other details. We couldn't put our faith in him. It wouldn't be worthwhile, because it might change. So God is completely solid and stable. He is not tempted by evil. Then James finishes up the verse by saying, and he himself does not tempt anybody. He's never done this, and he never will. It's not part of his nature. While he does allow it to occur, he's not the one tempting us. God does not tempt man to move away from him and into sin. He's too holy, too righteous, too good. So as you think about doctrine, understand that the better you know God, the less likely you will be to live in an unholy way, the less likely you will be to even think this. So the person James addressing here, this person doesn't understand God. And that's why they have to be told that. Don't think this way. Now look at the next verse. He said what temptation is not from. Now he's going to describe it in the process here regarding the lineage or the heredity of sin. verse 14, but each one is tempted when he is carried away and enticed by his own lust. Now, the phrase here, carried away, it means to lure away or to draw away. And you see the picture here of a fish hidden there in the shadows of a rock or some kind of outcropping. And the line goes into the water with the bait on the end of the hook, and the fish is lured out of his safety net and drawn to consume that bait, not knowing the destruction that's about to happen to him if he moves forward. Animals are safe when they're hidden and they're in their own element. But they can be drawn out with snares. They can be moved into a situation where their very lives are at stake. And notice what James says. Each one is tempted when he is carried away. There's a process here. There's a progress of temptation that grabs onto you and then carries you away to a place you don't want to be, although you think you might want to be there in the midst of the temptation. That's why you move in that direction. And so what happens is that the temptation is described here, connected with lust. Look at the end of verse 14. Carried away and enticed by his own lust. And again, the word enticed here means to lure or to catch or to trap. And if you think of a fish being caught by bait or an animal being caught by some kind of trap laid in the forest, it captures and brings death to that animal. And what is it that serves as the bait? Each one is tempted when he is carried away and enticed by what? By his own lust. So if you think, with these word pictures continuing, what's on the end of that fishing line? What's on that hook? In the picture here, your own lust is there. What's under that box that's set up so when the animal comes in and eats the bait, it falls upon him and captures him? It's your own lust. That's the bait. And so as you think about what's going on here, you're thinking, the bait is in my own self. The enemy is in me. Here's the treachery. Here's the nature of a traitor working on the inside being explained to you regarding temptation and lust. This is like a spiritual autoimmune disease. Within you is all that is necessary to tempt you. In this picture, you are the prey, and the temptation is luring you to be captured, and the bait is your own lust. Turn over to Romans 7:14. See the Apostle Paul talk about the indwelling sin in us that fights against us. Romans chapter 7. Find your way to verse 14 there. Paul says, "For we know that the law is spiritual, but I am of flesh, sold into bondage to sin. For what I am doing, I do not understand, for I am not practicing what I would like to do, but I am doing the very thing I hate." Have you ever felt that way? Like you want to do a good thing, you want to do the right thing, but you fall. And you wonder, why did I do that? How come I fell? I wanted to do right, but I did wrong. Paul felt that way. He did that same thing. Look at verse 16. "But if I do the very thing I do not want to do, I agree with the law, confessing that the law is good. So now, no longer am I the one doing it, but sin which dwells in me. For I know that nothing good dwells in me, that is, in my flesh, for the willing is present in me, but the doing of good is not. For the good that I want, I do not do, but I practice the very evil that I do not want. But if I am doing the very thing I do not want, I am no longer the one doing it, but sin which dwells in me." Now, be careful, because you could look at that passage and say, well, that means we're not responsible if I'm not the one doing it. God is speaking here through Paul, wanting to be very precise that you might be very precise in your understanding of how this all works. And the reason the precision is necessary is to keep us from thinking in error either direction. One error would be, I can't believe I did that. I must not be a Christian at all, because a Christian wouldn't do that. That's not right thinking. The other error would be over on this side, thinking, well, it's sin dwelling in me. It's not my fault. Therefore, it's not a big deal. Therefore, I'll just keep doing it because it's not really me. The precision's in the middle, and that is this. And this is only for those who've committed themselves to Jesus Christ. This is not for the non-believer. For the non-believer, he or she is the one doing the sin. But when God saves you, he places you in a position of holiness before himself as he looks at you through the eyes of, or through the blood of Christ. And so you are holy and blameless before him. Your eternal security is just that. It is secure because of what Christ has done and your faith in him. So God sees you there, yet you still sin. You still stumble. So what's going on there, positionally speaking, you are holy and blameless. You are clean before God. You are eternally cleansed. It's done. But you still sin. Why? Because there's still that sin that dwells inside of you. You see the connection with what James has been saying, that there's lust inside of you that causes you to follow after temptation. So that indwelling sin causes you to do what you don't want to do, and to do what you shouldn't do, and not to do what you should do, and it causes you to follow after the temptation. And so thinking with precision here helps you to understand more clearly who the real enemy is. The real enemy is not you in your person as you stand before God. The real enemy is the sin that dwells in you. Now, we're not talking that the ideal Christian is somehow sort of a spiritual schizophrenic, thinking that I'm here and I'm here. You have to see with precision. You're here, you're pure, you're holy, sin dwells in you. The enemy that you have to fight against is inside of you, and that is the indwelling sin. That is your lust that makes it possible for you to say yes to temptation. Now, one day, all this will be taken care of. On the other side, when we get into heaven, no more temptation, no more indwelling sin, no more lust inside to follow after those things. You'll be not just secure positionally, but practically. You'll be holy and blameless and sinless as you move forward in eternity. But for your life on earth, you carry this thing around. And listen, you can't get rid of it. There is false thinking out there that if I just work hard enough and I just read my Bible long enough, pray long enough, and this will all be taken care of, I'll never sin again. And then it comes. And either you're devastated or you have to relabel everything so that you don't really think you're sinning anymore because you committed yourself not to sin anymore, and now that you've walked with Christ for so many decades, you shouldn't be sinning. That's not the Apostle Paul's experience. That's not our experience. So, as Christians, even as we mature, and by God's grace, it's less and less, but sin will still be there. It will still dwell inside of you until God brings you home. Amy Carmichael, a missionary to first East Asia and then over to India, she worked with children who were being treated sinfully, indeed, over in that culture. She wrote a poem that speaks to this. Listen to what her words are. God, harden me against myself, the coward with pathetic voice, who craves for ease and rest and joy, myself, arch traitor to myself, my hollowest friend, my deadliest foe, my clog, whatever road I go. When we are tempted, when we fall into sin, it's not God. It's not circumstances, it's not our environment, it's not our background, it's not Satan, although he's definitely involved, and all these things are involved somehow, some way. It's not anything or anybody else, it's you. That's the problem. The temptation then brings nothing into us. What does it do? It draws out what's already in there. The lineage of sin is a tempted will and lust, like two parents, as far as the background goes, and they bring forth that sin. So now let's look at the life cycle. James gets even more specific, more graphic, as it were. This picture gets more clear. Beginning with verse 15. And we're going to see here in this verse conception, birth, growth, and offspring. When lust has conceived, what's he saying here? A person in the midst of temptation. Difficulty comes, and the mind begins to wrestle with the facts. Should I stay godly, or should I give in to the temptation? Now, maybe the mind is weak. Maybe it has had no time in the Word. Maybe no time in prayer, no pattern of living for God. Maybe it's filled with lies, untruths about God, about self, about the circumstances. Maybe it's just unaware that this is a serious temptation. On the other hand, it may be strong. Over in Hebrews 5 and verse 14, it talks about a mature mind that's been made mature because of practice and exercising the use of truth to overcome these sinful patterns. The heart plays a role as well. This is not just an objective wrestling in the midst of temptation. There's a subjective element to it as well. And the subjective is this, that how you feel will determine greatly what you'll decide to do. The soul of man is made up mainly of desires. And so what you want to do when you are fighting the temptation is to incline those desires in the right direction. It would be easier, and this is where the world goes wrong. The world thinks more education is the answer. If we just give them enough facts, then they will act rightly. Facts are vital in your fight to live a holy life, but they're not enough, because this is an objective battle and a subjective battle. Objective meaning black and white facts. Subjective meaning how you feel. The objective element is vital, that you would understand truth. And the more truth you have in your mind, the more truly you think about God and His ways and about yourself and about the circumstances, that feeds fuel to how you feel, the subjective part. And what you're trying to do in this battle is to convince how you feel to be based on the truth, those facts. It would be easier if this were just like a true-false test, or even a multiple choice test. Should I go this way or should I go this way? What's the right answer? What's the wrong answer? And we got the right answer because we opened the Bible and it says it. Okay, I'm going to do that. It would be great if that's all it were, because then we could just educate ourselves to the point where we knew all the answers. But since the fall, man consults his desire more than anything else. And that desire is corrupted. In the midst of temptation, ultimately, listen, ultimately you're going to choose to do what you want to do. And so the doctrine, the objectivity in the battle is all for the purpose of helping your will to understand more clearly what you should want to do. You're trying to get those desires to go in the right direction. Now, if you remove the objective entirely and you're just going to say, I'm going to do what I want to do and try to grow in Christ and not really think about the Bible, not pray, not try to fill my mind with truth, you're going to fail. Because on your own, you won't think rightly enough to make your desires go in the right direction. But Scripture gives you the ammunition, as it were, to get that will in line, to get those desires in the right direction, and then move forward and make the decisions that will most honor God. Your will is going to either hold temptation away and keep lust from acting out or yielding to lust, or it's going to give in and say, oh, I'd rather do that. In spite of all the objective truth, I want to go this way. That's what you're going to do. So, James says, when lust has conceived. Literally, this is the lust, when the lust has conceived. The one particular, to to the person in the midst of the temptation. A lust is just a desire gone bad. When we desire something too much, it becomes a lust. When we desire something more than God, it becomes a lust. The picture here, when it says lust has conceived, changes from the trapping of an animal or the catching of a fish to the birth of a child. A conception takes place when the process of sin unfolds in your own life. Lust, desiring to be satisfied, works with the temptation that's outside of you, the lust is inside of you, and they work together to bring the will under their submission. The lust, like a prostitute, entices the will to go out and embrace the forbidden thing. James gives us the picture of an unholy union taking place here between the will and the lust, and it follows through with conception. So when lust has conceived, look at the next few words. It gives birth to sin. This makes sense in the picture that James is painting for us. There's conception, and then there is birth. Now, the gestation, if we can use that word, for this birth of sin can be immediate, or it can last as long as is necessary for the person to get from where he is to where he needs to be to carry out his sin. So the birth of sin is the result of the union of the will with lust. The Bible calls this spiritual adultery. And you can understand that term in light of the picture given here, that we are, as we look at our souls, we belong to God. He is our husband, as it were. We are married to him, as it were. And when we move outside of that, when our wills are led to commit adultery with the lust and the temptation, and then the sin is conceived, that is something that's pictured as wandering away from our God. Look next what James says. He continues the picture. Conception, birth, and then growth. And when sin is accomplished, in other words, when sin is brought to completion or is full grown, you can think of an insect moving from a larva stage or maybe to some kind of caterpillar through the chrysalis into a winged insect. Sin grows up. It's not talking about your sinful life growing up, but just the individual sin being completed. It's reached its full development. And so you have conception and birth and growth, and then look what he says at the end of verse 15. It brings forth death. Here's the offspring. The offspring of this whole process is death. The child of lust is sin. The child of sin is death. So you can think of this picture in two ways. Sin is either a female or it's a male, but the idea is that the union committed by the will, embracing lust, is the production of sin, and then sin bears the offspring of death. Turn back to Romans 6:23. This is not the only time this is said in Scripture. The outcome of sin is death. Romans 6:23. A different word picture here. For the wages of sin is death. The idea that what you earn, like a paycheck, if you sin, will be death. Look down to Romans 7 and verse 5. For while we were in the flesh, the sinful passions, which were aroused by the law, were at work in the members of our body to bear fruit for death. The idea here is that death is what's produced by sin. Turn over to Romans 8 and verse 3. For what the law could not do, weak as it was through the flesh, God did, sending his own Son in the likeness of sinful flesh, and as an offering for sin, he condemned sin in the flesh. So this is where the gospel comes in. Sin is going to produce death. That's a guarantee. And because we are sinful, and there's nothing we can do to get out of that in and of ourselves, God sent His Son. And Jesus died on the cross because that was the penalty for the sin. God knew that's what sin would produce in each and every individual. And so He sends Christ. Christ lives His life on earth. Christ dies on the cross. And it's not just suffering to the point of some degree of suffering. It's suffering to the point of death. He dies because that's what you and I deserve. So sin brings about death and decay. And as you think of your own life, don't think of yourself just in and of yourself, although this is occurring in you. What happens is the death and the decay spread into the community. And it affects those around us. And so your decision to fight against this or just kind of go with the flow and let it happen is not only going to bring about corruption for your own soul, but it's going to impact those around you. Now, it can be the other way as well. You can fight against it and benefit your own soul and benefit the community around you. The lineage of sin, the life cycle of sin. Finally, look at the lie of sin. Verse 16. This particular verse, look at it like a hinge between what James has just said and what he's going to say, and we'll look at that next week, Lord willing. But he says in verse 16, "Don't be deceived, my beloved brethren." He calls us his beloved. James connects to those who are reading the letter. He cares about them. That's why he's speaking this way to them. He's telling them the truth that they might grow and be successful in their Christian lives. Now, what has he said thus far that we might not understand and be considered deceived about something? He says, don't be deceived. Well, we could be deceived about how sin works. We might not understand what he's just said, the process of sin. We might blame other people, blame other things, not understand sin dwelling inside of us, not knowing how temptation works, and that leads us to just a poor fight against it and an unsuccessful Christian life. We might be deceived, like it says over in Hebrews 3 and verse 13, let me read that to you. "But encourage one another day after day, as long as it is still called today, so that none of you will be hardened by the deceitfulness of sin." So we might just not understand sin, not really get it, think it's okay. It lies to us. It says, don't worry about it. I'm just going to go do my own thing. It won't really affect you. You're okay. And we just become more and more hardened. And we fall into temptation and we just run with it. And we don't really deal with it before God. We don't try to grow. We don't really know about repentance. And we don't know what that looks like. And so we become more and more hardened. We're not to be deceived about that as well. We might be deceived about the seriousness of sin and think, well, it's not that big of a deal. Listen to Mark 8 and verse 38. Jesus' words, "For whoever is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, the Son of Man will also be ashamed of him when he comes in glory of the Father and with his holy angels." So there Jesus calls the whole generation, the whole race of mankind, as sinful and adulterous. On our own, that's what we are. We might think we're better than we are, as an individual or as a people. We might think we're okay. We've developed over time. We're pretty good. Or we might not understand God's understanding of sin, how He looks at it. Turn over to Hebrews chapter 4 and verse 15. Hebrews 4 and verse 15. It is vital that we understand how God views these things. "Therefore, let us draw near." Oh, excuse me, verse right before that, verse 15. "For we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weakness, but one who has been tempted in all things as we are, yet without sin. So we understand that God being completely holy, completely separate from sin, we might be deceived and think, well, he doesn't understand it. He doesn't get how difficult this is to say no when I need to say no. And we forget that Christ came to earth, and he's our high priest, and he's been through all of these kinds of temptations. He didn't ever sin, but he can sympathize with us. Peter understood God's holiness. Do you remember back early in Jesus' ministry when Jesus was in the boat with Peter and Jesus performed the miracle, how Peter responded? He said, Jesus, you need to depart from me. You need to get away from me. Because he understood his sinfulness and he understood how holy Jesus was as God in the flesh. Well, you know the story. Jesus didn't leave him alone. He didn't get away from him. He brought him close. And he embraced him. And this is what we need to see as followers of Christ. That when we're wrestling with temptation, that we understand the workings of sin, its lineage, its life cycle, and its lie. And that we would flee to God, knowing that Jesus will embrace us if we call out to him and ask for mercy, ask for help, ask for grace, ask for strength. He's the one who will come alongside and help us to stop this life cycle of sin early on, at the temptation stage, and be able to say no. It's far easier to pull a weed out than it is to pull out a tree. And so you deal with the temptation at the temptation stage. You don't let it be conceived. You don't let it give birth. You don't let it grow and develop and give offspring of more corruption into your own life. You take care of it initially. Know the cycle of sin. When you're tempted, label it biblically. Call it what it is. Speak to yourself. Tell yourself the truth. God doesn't expect you to be confused about this. He expects you to think precisely about the details he's given in his word. So as you think about your own life, be a spiritual surgeon. Diagnose what's going on in you. Even do it out loud so that you might convince your will if it's being led astray, if it's going astray, as it's happening, go to God. God is all powerful, and he's completely willing to come alongside and assist you in his power to help you conquer the traitor of sin within you. Let's pray together.